Sahanavavatu, Sahanavapunavatu, Sahabiryam karavavahai, Tejasinavadhitamastu, Mavidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
First verse is a prayer verse, so those of you who have the first verse, you can chant with me. Otherwise, we'll just wait for verse 21. Sat pratyaya om sat pratyaya kin vihaya santam sat pratyaya kin vihaya santam prajesha chinta rahito hridakyah prajesha chinta rahito hridakyah Katam smaramas tamameyamekam. Katam smaramas tamameyamekam. Tasya smritis tatra dhudhayavanishta. It's 21. Videh prayatnas yachako pivadaha. Tayor dvayor mula majanatam syat. Videh prayatnasya cha mula vastu. Sanjanatam naiva vidhirna yatnah. Videhe. Sandhi videhe prayatnasya cha kopi vada. Should be vada. Oh yeah, there it is. Videhe prayatnasya cha kopi vada. That's sakara. Is it vasarga? Cha kopi vada. Tayoho dvayoho mulam ajanatam syat. Videhe prayatnasya cha Mula vastu sanjanatam na eva viddhihi nayatnaha. Kopi vadha. There is some discussion. Kopi means some. There's some vadaha, there's some discussion, debate, different schools of thought having different things to say about it, different religions having different things to say about it. So there's some debate, some discussion concerning viddhi and prayatna. Viddhi means fate, like the prarabdha karma, the karmas that caused you to take this birth and will carry you all the way through, your fate, your karma. And then prayatna, your free will. So there's some discussion around what is fate, what is your prarabdha karma, what is free will. Is there any free will? Is there any prarabdha karma? Is there any fate really? Or is there, if there is fate, is there any free will? How do these two things play against each other? What is the relationship between them? So there's, Kopi means there's some vada, there's some discussion over this. In fact, there's a lot more than some discussion over it. This particular question is whenever all of these years I've been studying with Swamiji, and whenever there's any type of satsang, somebody will always satsang, somebody will always ask this question. Is there free will? When there's the prarabdha karma, the karmas that brought you into this life, you know, what... How is there free will if there's prarabdha karma? What's the interplay between the two? Do I really have free will? It doesn't seem if I really analyze it, if I have free will. So it goes on and on. It's a question that comes repeatedly over the many years. So it's more than a little bit of a discussion. Everybody has it on their mind. So what he says is, so there's some discussion about this, the relationship between free will and karma. Then he says, tayoho dvayoho, of these two, the mulam, the source of these two, the truth of these two, the root of these two, ajanatam shat. So now he says, to finish the sentence, there is some discussion, some different schools of thought, different ways of thinking about the relationship between free will and karma and fate among those who do not know their source. Ajanatam means of those who are ajanatam, of those who are not knowing, who are ignorant of the mula, of the source, the root, the truth, the substrate reality of both of them. Okay? So this discussion is for those people who don't know, who don't know the root, the source of the two, okay? From that, from which these two have come. So for those who don't know. Videhe prayatnasya chamulavastu sanjanatam. For those people who have samyak, who have a very clear vision, a clear understanding, the sum means here clear, janatam, for those who clearly know, have clear understanding, then of what? For those who have clearly, for those who have clear understanding of the mula vastu, right, of viddhi and prayatna, of fate and of karma and free will, for those who have clear knowledge, nishta, a clear understanding of the mula, of the source of these two, then for those people, na eva viddhi na yatnaha. For them, there is no viddhi. There is no karma, nor is there any free will. So, that's the verse. So first let's just pretend like there is. From the standpoint, not pretend like there is really, that was misspoken. From the standpoint of you as an individual, means this body, mind, sense organs, jiva that is transmigrating through the, from taking birth after birth after birth, which is part of the whole Vedic tradition. You know, you can say, well, how do you know that you take birth after birth after birth? Well, actually, you really don't. You really don't. That's something which is scripturally revealed. You know, you can't prove it, even though you may have had a lot of different, some people have had past life experiences and all of that. But if you tell that to somebody, well, I've had past life experiences, so I really know that there's, that I do transmigrate. Then somebody will say, how do you know it's a past life experience? How do you know that that's just not a deeper aspect of your psyche that you're dipping into? And you say, well, it doesn't seem like that, and I feel quite certain. And then the other person, depending upon their orientation, would say, well, all right. I'm enough off. So what I'm saying is that's not something that you can establish. However, it is something that when a given tradition, like the Vedic tradition, and in fact 60% of the world population actually accepts that as a given, that there is such a thing as birth after birth after birth after birth. Your scriptural authority, which in India would be the Vedas, they accept that, and in fact it's an integral part of their whole theology. They don't accept at all that there's just, for some reason, you know, you've just been born here in a condition, in a situation which is actually extremely unfair and unequal. In other words, why would somebody be born and having to carry this burden, and another person is carrying this burden, and another person is carrying, they're all different burdens. Everybody has their burden, but they're all different, you know. And then some people get what we would in this day and age consider, you know, they are better off. This person is better off than me. And in some ways they are better off. In fact, if you try to look at the landscape of humanity and everything that's existing, you can find probably countless people that you would consider from your drishti, from your vantage point, as being better off than you. You know, and in various different areas too. They have more money, they have more health, they have more community, they have more intelligence. You go on and on and on. In fact, you name any given thing and you can think of people who are better off than you. Yeah. And the opposite is also true. You can think of many people who are worse off than you. In every aspect that you can think of, not just in one, any aspect that you can think of, there's all these people that are better off and all these people that are worse off, you know? And then there's people who are extremely better off, okay? And the people who are extremely worse off. And say in that condition, in that situation, which is a reality that we all are aware of, it's just being aware of the reality of our experience. And then you say, there is a God. These are all theological, at least in the Judeo-Christian theology. There is a God. And then how can that God justify this level of inequality if there is no prior condition? It's kind of an unanswerable dilemma. And I do try to answer it in various different ways. You can look it up on the internet or go to any of the philosophical journals and you can find a lot written on this. But it's a very difficult question to answer. There's no prior condition. And so what was God thinking? I will make you this way. And I'm going to give you all of this and you, I'm not going to give anything. Why is that? Oh, no reason. That makes no sense. It doesn't sit well with the intellect or with the heart, you know. And so for the different traditions, you know, theological traditions that accept, or spiritual traditions that accept reincarnation, that problem is basically solved because of the idea of karma. In other words, just like in this lifetime, from birth to death, you can see, you can understand as you look backwards, not so much as going forward, but as you look backward, you can see cause-effect, this led to this. And so you can see a certain justice or a certain sensibleness, a reason, a cause-effect reason for the events that are taking place in your life that you have something to do with. I did this and this was the result, that type of thing. So if you extend that cause and effect over lifetimes, then you can say, then this idea of what they call prarabdha karma comes into play, where this particular life that you're living right now is really an effect of your prior karma. And your prior karma, the prior karma that you have in your account, is actually beginningless and infinite from a Vedantic standpoint, because there's no first creation, so there's no first karma for you. It's beginningless, and so you have an infinite collection of karma, and out of that infinite collection of karma you have this particular life, which is really a trajectory based upon the choices you made, the decisions you made in your last life. Because if you have an infinite supply of karma, and believe me, I know you don't have to say, well, I don't know that I have an infinite supply of karma. I'm talking to you about what the Vedas say. I'm talking to you about that kind of the Vedic cosmology and their whole worldview. So that you know what we're talking about when we say Vidhi and Prayatna. When we're talking, when we use these words, karma and free will, I want you to know what they mean by it. Okay. And so, this particular lifetime, right, this particular lifetime is considered to be the exhaustion of a set of karma that was stored in your account, which now will fructify in the form of this life. And it will be directly related to your last life. In fact, they said your dying breath, your last thought, the last thought, is in fact the accumulation of who you are, of your whole value system. Just think about it. It's really interesting, you know, that last thought, and you don't really have free will at that time because your body's, you know, on its way out. You don't have that type of power to decide, you know, I'm going to have this for my last thought. People try to do that. I'm going to have this for my last thought. What they say is actually your last thought is the culmination of your life, of your value system. And in fact, they do different things to try to make sure that you have a positive last thought because that will set you on your, in a sense, set you on your course. Because it's that last thought is the accumulation of who you are and your value system. So that will set the trajectory. So in India, what they do is they'll always give you a name like Shanti. Name is like peace, or Ramakrishna, or Shiva, you know, or Shivaya. Some name like that, which is a name of the Lord, or it's a name of, or Sita, you know, for the feminine names. Kirti, these names that all evoke high values, or they evoke Bhagavan, you know. And so that because your name is something central to you, that name will perhaps help you in terms of that final moment to set that trajectory. And so often what the family will do is sit around the dying person and chant that name. Because that name was chosen for a reason, you know. And the name is something that's very integrated in you, and the name can transform into the value itself, that type of thing. Or they can sit and say a chant or repeat the name of the Lord just to try to hold your mind, you know, into a meditative, dharmic space, you know, rather than thinking about, you wish you could have one more Cherry Garcia. You know, or who's going to get all my money? People joke that who's going to take all my money? You know, my children are going to get all my money, and they don't know what to do with it. Yeah. I wish I would have written a more recent will. You know, all this type of samsara. So they try to direct the mind, you know, so that they can influence that trajectory. But actually, you know, sometimes Swamiji's talked about this, very difficult to do that. Mm. You know, because your value system, what is important to you is what's important to you. You can't, even if somebody's chanting your name at you or chanting Rama, 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 what's important to you is what's important to you, and that's just background noise, you know. And so the living a dharmic life, you know, a life of dharma, a life of values in an Indian home, and that tradition and that culture is extremely important, because it is those values that determine the trajectory of my next life, because they take it for granted that they will have a next life unless they gain liberation. And so that idea of this life itself being from beginning to end really being a product of your past karmas is something which is ingrained. That's why, in fact, in a way, it's a relief. A person moment when things, the good and bad events happen in your life, an Indian will often say, you know, well, that's my karma. That papa is over. You know, they look at karma in terms of the karma that takes you through your life in terms of punya and papa, where the karmas that you perform that are dharmic, they have a subtle, positive, subtle effect. It's called punya. Those type of karmas will generate positive experiences in your next births. Adharmic behavior, harmful behavior, will generate negative experiences. Generate negative experiences in future lives. And so, say you have this life and it's a relatively good life, you would want in your next life for it to be as this good or better. And the this good or better or this good or worse is dependent upon dharma. It's dependent upon dharma, punya and papa. The subtle effects of your behavior is what determines your future trajectory. You know? And the expression of punya and papa in that life. They say in any life is going to have 50% punya and 50% papa. So for everybody gets the equal experience in that way of, oh, this event is designed to make me miserable. It was designed for it. Now, I don't have to be miserable, but it certainly was not designed to make me happy. You know, I could be objective toward it and deal with it and not have my own shanti destroyed by the unhappy situation. But that's because of my own maturity or my own knowledge or my own sadhana, my own practice, that I can be whole and complete in spite of the very stressful or hard situation. You know? But if I'm not, I'm kind of alert and objective to the situation, you know, then the situation is not fun. And so I will experience pain from the situation. And the opposite is also true. You could say, God is great. This is the perfect situation. You know, I feel so blessed. I mean, I'm sure you can look back in your life and say, you've said these things. Oh, I feel so blessed. This is so wonderful. I'm so happy that this has happened to me. You know, everybody has those type of situations. You know, those the punya and papa. You know, there's some little punyas and papas throughout the day that you don't bother much about. It's the big ones. It's the big ones that are very, very challenging. Even the very positive ones are very challenging also because you're threatened by your knowledge that they can't last and that they need to be protected. So they're also challenging because of the fear they produce, you know. And the bad ones are very challenging because of the pain they produce, and it's not the fear of them going away, it's the fear that they won't go. Right? The positive ones, they're going to go. The negative ones, they're not going to go. And so that's how it is. You know? And so this is this punya papa that makes up every life and a series of experiences that take you through the life. It's a challenge for everybody on this loka, speaking from a Vedantic or Vedic point of view. So now, say you have that understanding, you're contained within that worldview, and you realize that, in fact, this life that I've been given, you know, is really a product of my past karmas. And that life was a product of past karmas, you know. And so the each life is setting you on a given trajectory. And from a Vedic perspective, your life, this life is not necessarily better than, it's not, what do you call, straight up. Like I start as a worm and then I become a, you know, a bird. And then I become this. And then finally I become an ape and then I become a human. Now that I'm a human, then I become a more mature human. You know, a more evolved human, and then a more evolved human, and then a more evolved human, until I see you and I say, you're such an old soul. You become an old soul. Okay. You know, Vedanta will say, we're all really old souls. Beginningless. It's beginningless. But how have you assimilated, to what degree have you assimilated your experience in terms of Dharma? That's what it amounts to. Because as you assimilate your experience in terms of Dharma, you mature as a person in the sense that you, over and over, I've been putting your hand in fire over and over again, you realize that an adharmic act on my part, even for the sake of pleasure, my pleasure, is not worth it because of the underlying tension and unhappiness and stress that it causes. We learn this over and over and over again. And finally, at some point in your life, in reference to this given thing, no. Anywhere that you're cutting corners, or in terms of your own honesty and integrity, wherever there's any corners cut, you just realize that it's not worth the stress that it causes. And slowly, slowly, you give all of that up. In terms of your anger or your temper or your unkindness toward others, the price you pay for it is so staggeringly painful, you know, that you give it up and give it up and give it up because it isn't worth it. It isn't worth it. You know, and that's kind of a long, drawn-out process. Here we are beginning this lifetimes, and here we're still working on it. You know, so this isn't all that easy. It's not all that easy just when there's no self-knowledge, because for every human being, my ananda, what I'm seeking in terms of my well-being and wholeness and fullness and freedom from pain, has its answer only in the relative world. And nobody wants to be in pain or to feel incomplete or disrespected or unloved. Nobody wants that. So now what happens when you see, oh, if I could just have that, I would be happy. I would be happy. I would be respected. I would be cared for. I would be loved if I could just have that. And so then you start wanting it and going after. These are the big desires. They're the ones that say, if I could have that, then I would be whole and complete. And then what happens is, of course, because it's out there and away from me, I have people that are helping me dissolve to get that. And parts of the creation are helping me. And then parts aren't. There are people and situations that are stopping me. They're obstacles. You know, and so the play of the obstacles, the aids and the obstructions on my psyche is very hard to handle. I go from, you know, first of all, the desire for this because it will make me whole and complete. And all of you, my best friends who are helping me, all of you, the good people, you know, you're all the good people, the kind people, the mature people, the people who help others. And then there's the rest of you. The rest of you that don't care for the most part, but then there's the group. There's the group that seemingly don't want me to succeed. Nor they want that for themselves, and they don't want me to have that. Very selfish people. Very selfish people. They don't care about anybody. They don't care about me. They only care about themselves. You know? I really can't stand people like that. And they're ruining my life. You know? I hate them. So this is the emotional, you know, currents that are run through the psyche based upon my need, you know, to fulfill myself, to be happy. And to the degree that your need, that you place the fulfillment in the physical world, the more torn apart you are. And then you realize that as you start taking shortcuts in terms of getting what you need, doing dishonest things to get what you need, bumping people off to get what you need, you know, you realize that even though you're getting what you need, you're also creating an underlying stress you know. Even though you're starting to get what you need, you're fighting against yourself because you're doing a dharma, and that's making things worse on a deeper level. So all this has to be figured out. At some point, you start to realize that it's better to do dharma and not get what you need out here. Because you can give up what you need out here if you're doing dharma, because the dharma creates shanti, which creates peace in your mind and a sense of well-being that is actually free and not dependent upon the acquisition of objects or situations. That's why people become dharmic, because it's the dharma, really, it's the following of dharma that gives you the shanti. We learn this. It's like sticking your hand in fire. But then it's still not enough. Because it's still relative. So I continue to seek myself, you know. I continue to seek some understanding and some truth, but at least I have a relative shanti because of dharma. And so dharma is something, we teach dharma, all of the religions teach it, all of the value systems teach dharma. But it's also the universe teaches dharma also. Because of pleasure pain, because of depth of pleasure, depth of shanti versus painful pleasure. Yeah. A dharma is pain, can give you painful pleasure, but dharma with pain because things aren't, you're not getting your way in the world, that's a pleasurable pain. It's a pain that's taking place in shanti, being held by shanti, being held by peace, a sense of well-being, inner well-being and peace. And we gravitate toward that as we assimilate our experience. So this dharma, the understanding of dharma goes through all of the spiritual traditions, and in terms of the Vedas, the whole understanding of life and afterlife is based upon dharma, you know. And so now say, that's just to give you a little bit of another layer of understanding there. Now say you know that your next life and the circumstances of life, because you're very familiar with how bad life can be and how good life can be. What type of horror story can be there? What type of horror story you can be born into? You know, you care about your actions. You take it all seriously. You know, not because, and for selfish reasons, really. You know, it's selfish reasons on the right side, but it's so that I can have a better situation next time. But now, what you, at the same time as all this is going on, you're also realizing kind of the interconnectedness of all of your actions with the situation that you find yourself in now. The interconnectedness of this moment is based upon everything I've done up to now while I've been alive, plus all of the effects of my past lives and my karma. Okay? And so now, here I am. And at this point, where I am a product, this moment, let's put it, this moment, at this very moment, I am, and my situation is a product of past moments, of past karma. Not just this body, this mind, this sense organs, the very conditioning of my antakarana, the very conditioning of my mind. Okay? And so, how can there be free will if this moment that I find myself in is a product of my past karma? Even my choices, any choice I make, is going to be so heavily, you know, influenced by all of my past actions that have produced this person at this time with this mind, with these inclinations, with these desires. And so how can there be any free will in that? That's the argument that often comes. And so, because there's so much influence, what Vedanta will say there is that there is extraordinary influence is true. that this prarabdha karma, the prarabdha karma that is going through your life, right, giving situation after situation after situation after situation until you die, these situations are given, they're givens, you know. And then within each situation, your actions, which have produced more karma, right, is also influencing the situation. Where is there any space for free will? What we would say is, within the prarabdha karma, at any given moment, which is totally conditioned by the prarabdha karma, you have the ability to choose. Even though the choice is influenced by all of the karma, all of your past karma, and you are a product of all of that karma, everything that you feel, everything that you think, all of the thoughts that, you know, all of the situations that you find yourself in, the way your mind thinks, has given you this moment. But in this moment, you have a buddhi. A buddhi means an intellect, which is capable of discerning and thinking over and analyzing your situation. You have the capacity to be objective, to learn, and to choose. Even though all of that is taking place within a conditioned environment. And so what that means is that the Vedanta will accept completely that the free will, you know, the free will and the karma are totally intertwined. Totally intertwined. You can't take the free will outside of the karma. How are you gonna do that? Because its life is within the karma. You see what I'm saying? But you have that capacity to choose. If you don't have a capacity to choose, to do, then there's no punya papa. You're back in that same old situation where this is just, you know, Ishwara, which it is just Ishwara. That's also true. This is just Ishwara. You know? But is there a jiva who accrues punya and papa based upon choice? Based upon dharma and adharma? If you say no, then in a sense, there's no rhyme or reason to you being, there's no way you can say you're responsible for your experience. There can really be no accruing karma for you. So there's really no punya or papa for you. It's just an illusion. And so, within the relative reality, this world of duality, this world of a transmigrating jiva, say yes, there is prarabdha, which the free will can't be extricated from. Nevertheless, there is still free will, because you have the capacity to choose between right and wrong. You have the capacity to actually use your willpower. You have the capacity to use your willpower. You have the capacity to say no. You have the capacity to go against your inclinations. You have the capacity to go against your desire, you know, because of a higher value. And so therefore, from a shastric standpoint, they accept prarabdha karma and a free will intertwined and within that. But that prarabdha karma and free will is only from the standpoint of the jiva, the body, mind, sense organs. What about you? What about the Atma? What about your being? Is there prarabdha karma for you, for the self? Is there free will for the self? Is there prarabdha karma, say, Ishwara's total, the total karma of Ishwara? Is there prarabdha for the whole, for Ishwara? Is there free will? That's like saying, is yourself a doer? Okay. Is the Atma a doer? Is the Atma, is the self bound by time? Is consciousness bound by time? If you say consciousness is bound by time, then consciousness is a jiva. right? If your consciousness is bound by time, then consciousness has to be a jiva, existing within the creation. If consciousness is free of time, then where's doership? Where's free will? Where's prarabdha karma? So that's why here Ramana is saying, you know, the whole debate that we are racking our heads about the relationship between free will and karma, and it's a valid question also from the standpoint of understanding what's going on within the creation. It's nice for the mind to have some peace and some rest around that in relative terms. But in reference to you, to your being, there is no prarabdha karma. There is no free will. There's just simply your timeless being, which has been exactly the same without any modification whatsoever, going back from the standpoint of the universe, going back to infinite amount of time, and going forward an infinite amount of time from your position, you simply are. Your amness, the being that you are, just simply is. You are not racing through time. You are not modifying as a result of the karmas that are taking place on this level of reality. Mm. And so for somebody like Ramana, you know, he spent so much time just simply being with himself, and now sitting there with his eyes open, he's just simply being with himself. And the question seems ridiculous. You know? Ridiculous, if not ridiculous, on this level. But in terms of thinking of myself in reference to my free will or my prarabdha karma, it's kind of a misnomer. It doesn't have anything to do with me. And so the thing is for us as jnanis, as you gain nishtha in your knowledge, is to be able to recognize both. You need to recognize your own changelessness. Just the abiding shanti, the abiding nature of your being, the changeless nature of your being that is present to all of the experiences that you're experiencing, all of the experiences that are coming and going. All of the punya and papa, the very nature of this life. And you can see the karmas taking place. You look at the karmas as Ishwara, you know. Like this life is taking place and unfolding before me. And I have to look at that and accept that as Ishwara, and where I can make modifications, you know, because just like say I were to hurt my arm, say I were to break my arm, I could decide, well, because I have a choice, I can decide, well, after all, that's not me. So let it be broken. I'd never do that. You immediately will go and you'll do what it takes to heal your arm if you possibly can. That's being human, you know? So that's understanding one level of reality. Similarly, if you're working, what we call it kaushalam, doing appropriate actions to make this world have more relative shanti for you in terms of your experience. That's natural for us to do. If I've understood in my experience, in the assimilation of my experience, if I've understood that over and over again, understood until I finally understood it, really understood it, is that dharma or kindness, you know, patience, gives me so much more happiness than being the other way. It gives me so much more happiness that I choose that behavior until that behavior becomes natural. I have a choice, you know. Somebody could upset me and then I could go off on a... I could go with the upset. And everybody gets hurt and, you know, so many problems are created because I've gone off with the upset. And so maybe I've done that many times and still I realize what a situation that causes, and so I pull back. I make a choice. I don't want to do that because it's not worth it. And this is what we do. We keep making these choices. This behavior isn't worth it. This behavior isn't worth it. Getting all riled up about this desire that's not being fulfilled, it isn't worth it. And we keep learning and learning and learning. like that. In relative reality, even if you're a jnani, it's kaushalam. Oh, this doesn't work very well. You know, if I do this like in this way, it doesn't work very well. It's better to do it like this. You will be learning all your life. You learn how to be in the world, and you gain kaushalam, you gain skill in how to be in the world, whether you have knowledge or not. But at the same time, so that's normal, you know. But at the same time, you are there always the same. So you're gaining skill in the world to keep your body as healthy as possible, and to keep your mind at relative shanti by the way that you behave in the world. You're learning that all of the time. But you're not thinking that now I'm becoming more pure. Now the Atma, now myself is becoming higher, yeah, or more subtle. It's not becoming anything other than what it is and always has been. Your Atma is not going to improve, and it's not going to get worse. It is what it is. It's free. What do you mean by moksha? It's free. Yourself is free. It's not going to become better, not going to become worse, not going to change. It's not going to be born, and it's not going to die. It's beyond all of that. Totally beyond all of that. There's no death for the self. That's why you can... There's not even... I mean, none. That's why, you know, when you wake up from a dream, you know how the whole dream goes away, and all the dream characters go away? You go away, the character that you had in the dream, all gone like that. And absolutely nothing has happened. It's not like, oh my gosh, that dream character has disappeared and ripped part of me away with it in its disappearance. There's absolutely nothing that happens. When I was coming back, some of you know the story that's relevant right now. When I was in India, you know, in the 70s, early 70s, I'd been with Swamiji for about 6 months, going to his classes every day, three or four classes a day. And then I got hit with some cholera. So we were taking a train all the way down from Dehradun, which is up near Rishikesh, all the way down to Chennai. It's like a three-day ride. And three-day train ride. And I had eaten a mango that they think had some mosquito problem. And anyway, somehow I picked up this cholera. Mm-hmm. And so by the time the train arrived, I was really almost dead, I guess. But of course, I never felt bad at all. I've got going through all the agony of the cholera and just the vomiting and on both ends, just unbelievable. And apparently they had a wheelchair waiting for me, and they were pushing me to, and I remember my visions going in and out, and my hearing going in and out, and I was totally weak, but I didn't realize how weak I was. But it never once, I mean, actually all these experiences were taking place, it never once even occurred to me that I was dying, because nothing's happening to you. Something is happening to your body for sure. And I was very aware of that, and I was watching my sense organs going in and out and all this. I mean, incredible things were happening. I was definitely sick. There was no question about that. But it never occurred to me that I was dying, because the me, the self, was not. And so, remember, I'd been having all this talking with, I mean, going to these classes with Swamiji all of this time. By the time they got me to this clinic that was actually run by a group of doctors that were Swamiji's doctors, who were devotees of his, they got me into the clinic. And by the time they got me onto the table, I was totally kind of black, my skin gone black. I had no pulse, nothing. And at that time, my body and everything disappeared, and I had one, and this must have only lasted for a very short time, because they got glucose in me, and I came swooshing back into my body. But I had this one thought, that, and it was, there was just the thought. There was no body, there was no nothing. It was, this is what Swamiji was talking about. That was the thought. This is what he's talking. And then they've got that glucose in me, and kind of like an ocean wave, I came swooshing back into the body. And I was laying on this table, and I was kind of opening my eyes, and Swamiji came. He had come. He had found out about this. And he's the one that had arranged for them to take me to the clinic and everything. And then he came shortly. He was arrived shortly. And he was coming in right after I had woken up from this situation, because I just was dehydrated. That was a problem. It was destroying him, killing me, actually.
Yeah, that's cholera.
That's cholera, yeah. And so then he came, and I told him about the whole thing that had happened. Yeah, the whole thing. And he went like this. He put his hand on my knee like that. He said, "Very good." Yeah, very good. Very good. Now you know. That was a good experience, but now you're back, you know, so that was good. And then he said, then he dropped this bomb on me, telling me that he had arranged for me to stay somewhere in Chennai, because everybody was leaving. He was going to give some talks, you know, up in Udi, I think it was.
Udi.
There's another thing that starts with a K anyway, somewhere. And so, I said, no, I can go. I can go. I'm fine. I said, and then I went to pull my head up, you know, and I could not even lift my head off. I couldn't lift my head. But why was that? The whole point of this is that nothing happens to your being. So these are good experiences. You have to recognize that now, though. It's the same now as whether you're, you know, waking up for a dream, or it doesn't make any difference. That's the reality. In your day-to-day experience or your emotional life, all of this, where we think we're just being, you know.
Also, when you're aging.
When you're aging, that's how many old people, like my mom told me. She said, "It's no fun to be old, honey." Then she goes, I'm the same person I was, you know, when I was young. But now, you know, it's hard. It's hard to be in this body. She said that. Bertrand Russell said the same thing. It's hard to be old in an old body. I'm just the same. You know, nothing ever happens to you. That means there's no karma for you. Even in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, and in the Katha Upanishad, Krishna says in the Gita, the one who says, "I'm the killer," or "I'm the killed," neither knows. Neither one knows. The self is neither the... They use an extreme example. Yourself is neither the killer, nor is it the killed. Yourself is always, always the same. What is so freeing about that is that no matter what your experience, the experience of the mind, the experience of the body, the experience of the world, all of this tumultuousness that goes on just by the nature of creation is taking place in a self which is free and not going through the slightest ripple. So the moksha, liberation, is that viveka. The viveka that allows the ahankar, to land on you, not on the tumultuous mind or the tumultuous body or the tumultuous situation. The ahankar, the I, has its identity with who you really are. You're not the experiences that are coming and going that are objectified. You're not your objectified experiences. They come and go. If you were them, you would be gone. Every moment, every millisecond, you'd already be gone. You wouldn't even be here. You wouldn't even be able to find yourself, because time is infinitely divisible. You're already gone before you try to find yourself. There's no self then. But that isn't your experience. It's just your experience is that I am always here and I'm always having these experiences, which then goes into I am these experiences. You're not these experiences. You're the self of all of these experiences. And so the mind has to wake up to that. It has to discover that through all of these different teachings that are pointing pointing towards your own being so that you gain nishta, gain clarity. Gain clarity means that no matter what's going on here, I am here the same. And so the mind begins nishta, becomes rooted in myself, and then from the standpoint of me, I experience whatever the world, whatever Ishwara has to give. You know? But the commitment, the attachment is to what is real, which is myself. That's what the mind is attached to, that because that's where the wholeness and the ananda is. And then from that vantage point, I experience all of this. And all of this includes not only what I perceive through my sense organs, but what I experience in my body, what I experience in my mind, my moods, my emotions. I see them all as karma, the intricate play of karma. Karma means cause-effect. This situation is thrown up now because of an infinity of cause-effect relationships that are producing this. Even any emotion you experience, any emotion, so many things have come into play in these interrelationships that have actually produced this emotion. You can't just produce it by yourself. These emotions are they're given. They're produced by the interplay of so many different variables, so many different people, you know, and all of their karmas, all of these karmas coming together to produce these emotions, to produce these feelings, to produce these joys and these hurts. So after a while you just allow that to be Bhagavan. Because it is Bhagavan. You allow it to be Bhagavan and then just experience the salt and pepper of the life. Yeah, with some chili powder. In the Katha Upanishad, there's one verse where Yama is like, Lord Yama, Lord Death, is likened to the chutney, a pickle. Bhagavan's pickle, you know, Lord Death. Just throw some chutney on there.
You know? For the body.
But you can't. It's all that. There is no such vision if there's no whole self that's free of it. You know? You can't have that type of objectivity in a true sense, in a real sense, if there's no free person inside, you know, who's not being affected by it. You know? When there's a free person inside who's not affected by it, then this is all Ishwara, this is the nature of the creation, you know, is all taking place in me. So that vision itself allows for that viveka, you know, that discrimination, allows for that objectivity. You can't objectify what you take to be you. There's no objectivity there because who's the subject? That's why viveka discrimination is so important. You can't objectify what you've identified with. Right? Otherwise, if you can objectify it, then you have some viveka and there's ability to recognize yourself. And so, here, you know, for somebody who has that, for me, then, and this is just, it's for me, for the self, there is no karma. There is no prayatna. There is no karma. There is no effort. I'm free, totally free of all of that. And then, all of that has its reality within this level of existence. And then, I have to gain skill. Because to handle this really challenging creation, challenging life. You ask any one of us. See, has any one of us not had a challenging life? I'm positive. You can say, oh, my life has been really wonderful. I can say that it's been a really wonderful life. And I'll say, right alongside of it, and it's been very tough. And it's been very challenging. In fact, there's some exercise sometimes I used to ask my students to write down on one side of the page the fairy tale of your beautiful life. And there is. You do have the fairy tale side. And then on the other side, you have like this scary horror story. And so...
Macbeth, Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yeah, yeah. But it's so interesting that you'll have both, you know.
Well, which list is longer? Are there 50-50?
Well, it depends on where you're putting your focus.
Yeah.
You know, because everything can be divided in more detailed. But you're not on either side. You're the self of both sides. You know, so where does the mind need to root itself in that what's real, and then objectively handle, you know, the experiences that come your way. That's why understanding Ishvara and all of that is so important, because it gives the jiva, its body, mind, sense organs, a vision, you know, of its place in the scheme of things, which helps very much in the being able to handle the relative life as it unfolds. That's enough. We'll do more next week. Let's take a minute. Purnamidam, Purnamidam, Purnat, Purnamudachyate, Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Harihi Om.
When you were describing that cholera experience, you didn't seem to be very concerned about the condition of the body or the condition of the mind.
I think you're so weak at that time that your thought isn't really about that, because you're too weak to be thinking about that.
But your thought was about your own being, though. You had that. That was still present.
Still present, but I wasn't thinking about it. I was taking it totally for granted. That's why it never occurred to me as, oh, I'm dying or something, because there was no such experience. You have to have that experience. Oh, it's happening, I'm dying. Mm-hmm. It's like when Steve Jobs said, when he was dying, he goes, wow. Wow. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I was thinking, you know, what is it? What if it must be a kind of a pleasant surprise for people who are so certain.
Yes.
It's like oh wow. that wasn't true after all.
But were you thinking at the time, or was there a process there?
I was thinking. No, I wasn't.
Self-evident, or what was that like?
You were self-evident means there's no fading. See, that's the thing. You don't think, oh, look, I'm self-evident. Mm-hmm. It's just that.
But it was self-evident.
Yeah, there's no experience of loss or change, mm-hmm, in you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no fading, no change, nothing. All kinds of stuff was going on in the body. But since I never felt a self-loss, even though the body was next to dead, that didn't occur to me.
So there was no damage.
No damage. There's nothing that happens.
Yeah.
And it's so funny because your sense organs are going in and out. You count, your body is just in this wheelchair, and all this stuff is happening. But the point is that it never occurred that something's happening to me, mm-hmm. because nothing was happening to me. Mm-hmm. It's the same. We take these things for granted. It's just like, I think, that waking up from the dream in the morning. You just take it for granted. In fact, that dream is such an Achilles heel that the dream exists, you know, is that you can experience yourself being part of a universe and then being without it, and that's perfectly all right. Another thing, this is a good way to understand Ishwara. When you go into a dream, sometimes you have a body in the dream, and sometimes you don't. Sometimes it's just the situation, whatever it is. You're not identified. There could be hundreds of people in the dream, but you're not identified with any body in the dream. You know what I'm talking about? Like, it's just scenery. And you are the self of the scenery. Now, don't you think that would be a little weird? You're not identified with any body. You're just the whole. That is perfectly all right with you. And then you go and you have a body and you're experiencing the scene from within, from out, from the sense organs. And then that's perfectly all right with you. Body, no body, it doesn't make any difference because, in fact, you're the self of the whole. Whether there's a body, whether there's a universe, whether there's no body, whether there's no universe, from the standpoint of you, it makes no difference at all because you are the self of the whole thing. You are what is actually there, you know? It's like, you know, that's why they use like the clay pot example, because you can understand that from the standpoint of the pot, it can be so afraid, you know, of it, it's losing itself. But from the standpoint of the clay, there is no pot. There's only clay. Look at the clay. Where is there a pot that is not me? There isn't. You know, and it's the same in reference if you use your imagination and you say you imagine a meadow. From the standpoint of you, the one, the conscious being from whom this meadow imagination has come, right? You have no fear or care one way or the other. It is not important to you that the meadow imagination would all, it can be a very complex imagination. But from the standpoint of you, there's no fear. It's abhayam. There's no fear at all. How long is the imagination going to stay? From the standpoint of the self, the imagination has no being other than me, and I'm not coming and going. Like if I think this thought, I ask you, you know, think of a pear tree, think of an apple, think of the sky, you know. I can go on and on asking you to have this image, now I have this image, now I have this image, now I have this image. You remain as the self, you know, in whom these images are coming and going. You don't feel like, oh, this image is going to go, so something's going to happen to me. It doesn't even occur to you. You know, but because it doesn't occur to you because nothing happens to you. That's why these things that are totally taken for granted have to be dissected so you understand that. In fact, when you're just walking around day to day, in moment to moment to moment, to notice the entirety of your experience goes on changing, 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 and nothing is happening to you. You, the viveka, you need to see that. And as the mind recognizes that, what happens is that your own the fullness and the wholeness of who of your own being becomes more to the forefront from the standpoint of the mind. Because your mind, the viveka, that discrimination is more and more there. So what happens is from the mind standpoint, it notices me. Rather than just, if it doesn't notice me, it just takes me for granted. Totally for granted. You know, of course I'm the self of every thought. But its focus is only on its thought, thoughtness. Not on its, on me as its content. And after some time of noticing this, you recognize the name and form of the thoughts go on changing, pervaded by the clay potness of my own presence, you know? And that becomes so clear to the mind. And then you ask yourself, what am I like? Am I a bummer? What's my being like? You know? And then you realize that there is nothing more dear to you. I'm not talking about bliss states. I'm talking about you. Right now, this me is what is the most dear. And once that is recognized, that's it. For me, that was really a big recognition. Because I think I've always thought about different bliss states or something which isn't already here. And I think a lot that happens to a lot of people. You're thinking about what isn't here already, rather than how very dear your own being is. You'd give up any bliss state for your own being. Who cares? Just let me be here. That me is the Atma. You know?
But what was interesting is that it occurred to you that this is what Swamiji was talking about, and it was there.
Yeah, what a thought to have. Ooh. That was a thought that in an unembodied state.
Yeah.
It was just me with this thought wafted through. That's weird.
Yeah.
It didn't last, though, because I immediately
came back
into the... And I even knew as that thought was there that this is strange.
Mm.
It wasn't quite words saying this is strange, but there was a recognition that, wow,
it's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the real recognition, the thought was, this is what Swamiji says. This is exactly what Swamiji says.
That was marvelous.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you describe, for me, I experienced that, you know, I keep remembering, Ram Dass said one time that as long as we're not resting in the place that doesn't change, we'll be afraid of the place that does. And that in that resting...
Mm, that's, I like that, yeah.
There's a... call it a self, or there's something, you know, my friend of mine is also who knows you from way back in India, but uses the same stories, and you say, okay, you're that car on the street, and the sound of my voice, you know, that's the same, that recognition itself, the quality of recognition, is my experience. Don't you? You know, it's the part that may notice the body's going through this or that, or, you know, things are unfolding the way they are, but it doesn't change.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It makes sense. The one that doesn't change isn't even performing an act of knowing. Mm-hmm. The buddhi is there that needs to... that gives that sense of knowing.
Mm-hmm.
But just like the sun's not performing an act of illumining, it's not doing it. It just is that, and because it is that, everything's illumined. Because you are that, everything is known, everything is, you know, lit up.
I see.
Just a little...
It's not doing it, you know...
It's not doing an act of knowing. It's just pure conscious knowledge. Me, even when you sit, you know, if you do, where you can really see what I mean by those words is if you ever do japa, you know, like the repetition of a mantra. And with japa, it'll start out where it's mantra silence, mantra silence, mantra silence. But after a while, it's just the mantra rising in the silence, rising and setting in silence. And then when that type of differentiation or that viveka is there to where you can differentiate just the nature of your own being and the rising of the mantra, then have the mind, your mind just ask this, am I the consciousness, me, my own presence, am I knowing anything? Am I performing any act of knowership in reference to these thoughts? And just sit with that and see. Then you can, even with the question, am I doing that? There's enough differentiation there so that you can recognize your own nature. Is consciousness, the me, doing anything? You say, no, not at all. Is there anything wrong with that? No, because I'm the me, the self, is the non-doing, silent, changeless being that is the truth of all the doing. But I myself am not doing anything, and it's very evident. That's a good, japa is really good to highlight that. And then once you recognize that in japa, then now, and when you're engaging in conversation with people and walking about, you can say, ask the same thing, am I doing anything? And you'll say, no, I'm not doing anything at all.
That's what's beloved. I mean, that's...
Yeah, and what is the nature of that one that's not doing anything? Is what we mean by ananda. See, you cannot define ananda by any experience that comes and goes. So if you have a bliss state, no, that's not it. That's relative bliss and all of that. But when we say that the self is ananda, what they're talking about is the very nature of your being, and it is not coming and going, and it's not hidden. So it doesn't matter what the vritti, what the thought modification is, that ananda of yourself is not covered over by anything, just like consciousness isn't covered or being isn't covered, ananda is not covered at all. It's just that we're used to only thinking of the word ananda in reference to mental cognitions, emotional, positive emotional states. That's how we define ananda. And so that means that we're not, then we say, oh, I hear Swamiji jokes about this all the time, making fun of us. They'll say, oh, Swamiji, this is him talking. Oh, Swamiji, I understand this. I understand this so clearly, but... And then Swamiji, there's the but. No but. I understand this so clearly, but my mind, Swamiji, my mind, you know, the wholeness of myself, the fullness of myself, just isn't here like it's supposed to be. Well, we do naturally, just like you want a healthy body, you do want some shanti in your mind. That's legitimate. But that's not what a person is saying. A person will feel that the ananda, which is the nature of the self, comes and goes. If that experience of the ananda of yourself comes and goes based upon the mental experiences. And that isn't true. The only reason you think that is because you've defined ananda as these changing mental experiences. This is not the ananda of the self. You have to recognize, what is beloved? What do they mean by ananda when they're talking about me, the self that is present to every experience I have? Where is that ananda? What is that? That's here right now in full force. Not, it has to be differentiated from these bliss states. And that's a wonderful, wonderful meditation, because when you get that, it makes a difference. It really makes it, for me, it made a big, big difference.
Well, that belovedness that dearness is stable.
It is stable, and it's more dear than any bliss state. A bliss state is that's fun and nice and all of that, but it's nothing. It's nothing. It comes and goes.
It's conditional.
It's conditional. And the fullness and wholeness of yourself is not conditional. And that is really the freedom to be able to say, I am free. It's recognizing yourself. That is the one who's free. But for the mind, that is really moksha for the mind, because the mind has recognized at that time that everything that I seek, I am going to its own content, the self. And that the mind itself, which is always changing and traveling here and there, can never, ever, even if it wanted to, get away from that wholeness. It's impossible. The mind, so there's in that one verse, I think, again, it's Katha Upanishad, I think. It said, you know, you can send your mind to the moon and back, but the self is already there. Mm-hmm. No matter what the mind does, what it feels, what it thinks, what is happening to it, it cannot get away from that self. And once the self, the ananda has been differentiated, you know, I'm not talking at all about a new experience. I'm talking about recognizing how dear you are. There's nothing that matters more to you than your own being. That's what we mean by ananda. Mm. Wouldn't give it up for anything. You wouldn't say that about something that's painful. Anything painful, negative, no. I'm happy to let that go. But your being is something else. It's not negative. It's something that is the most dear. So you have to just do some contemplation on what that means. And it has to be that which is here right now. So you can't use that excuse that, oh, this vritti isn't the right kind of vritti. This thought's not the right kind of thought. So no, no excuses.
If only.
Yeah, only but.
Well, even if it's not the right kind of thought, you're still dear to yourself.
That's what's to be recognized. What is that dearness? Yeah. That's the freedom. And there's nothing, you're helpless to do anything about it. And that's a real freedom, because you not only can't make it worse, you can't make it better. And we're all such high achievers, you know. Maybe I could, you know, tweak it a little bit and make it a little better. No, you can't.
The mind works so hard.
Yeah.
It's poor mind.
Yeah. It's a huge relief to know that on both sides, you know.